Thus, the disciple comes to know himself, to understand his past, and to foresee his future and his goal. Gone now are all doubt and questioning. Standing by the Master's side, hearing his voice, inwardly illumined by his presence and his power, the disciple knows with utter certainty that this is his way, and that none other can ever call him any more. Far below, yet clearly visible, discordant with the market cries of men, proclaiming mentally and physically the value of their wares, their prices, and the other payments they demand, the fretful world is seen and heard. Gazing into his master's eyes, the disciple knows that his work lies in the world. In his turn, he must now become the guide of other questing souls. Amidst the discord, many harmonies are heard. Brave men and women fight the evils from which the discord comes. Awakening souls await the opening of the doors, the coming of the spiritual guides. None must ever wait or call in vain, the Master says. Be thou their guide, as one has guided you. Blessed communion, deepest intimacy, in perfect understanding, such is the companionship between disciple and adept guru or spiritual teacher. No shadows ever wholly dim its light, for even if the pupil fails, the master will not withdraw. His love not fail to point towards the upward way. No mistake is final, he says, no error irredeemable. Atone, therefore, and make of this fall a stepping stone to greater wisdom and fewer faults. Each fault remedied leads to faultlessness, which is the goal. Chapter 8, The Path and the Goal. Serene within, however tired and tried without, the pilgrim soul pursues the next phase of his journey. Steeper, rockier now he finds the way. Pitfalls threaten him, generating watchfulness. Traps endanger him, developing wariness and caution. Thus his feet become more firmly set upon the path, wisdom deepening with each success. Ever the master watches, ever and anon appears to bring new tasks and to give counsel, warning and encouragement, for the disciple is deeply loved by his guru. The comradeship is enjoyed of other pupils of the same teacher, and also the pupils of other masters and other schools. All are filled with light desire to conquer self and serve the world. Vision awakes. The flesh loses power. The body as a tomb is opened, the sealed stone rolling away. Yoga frees the soul. The disciple begins to know firsthand and to obey the basic laws of life. He discerns the powers and the intelligences by which the ordered emanation and perfection of the universe and all that it contains continually occur. He is a man now, full grown, able to stand erect and unafraid before nature's mightiest powers and intelligences, understanding them. Power descends from monadic heights, enlightening and strengthening him, and thus his path is trod. The pilgrim nears his goal. The final test awaits him still. Unconsciously, he has been preparing for and even passing it for many lives. Now it must be faced and final victory gained. It is the test of uttermost selflessness, of the last surrender, of the sense of being a separated self. The thought that I am I has been inherent in his very soul throughout the ages. The sense of I am-ness is imprinted almost indelibly upon the very atoms of his vehicles, engraved upon the tablets of his mind, sculptured upon his nerves and brain. Inherited from countless ancestors is the knowledge, I am I. That deep-rooted sense of I am-ness is not to be dispelled with a gesture of the will and mind. The well-nigh ineradicable conviction can only be erased by lives of patient mental effort and selfless living. Each experience upon the path has aided him. All visions of a wider life and every realization of the unity of all broaden and expand his consciousness. The tragedies of loss upon loss of all he held most dear, the stripping of his soul of all external power and circumstance, the progressive denudation through which he has passed, all these serve to reduce the power of the habitual thought of separated self-existence. When, therefore, the final test is made, he is in part prepared, but not wholly so, since the impress of the thought of having been created distinct and separate from every other being on earth remains deep within his inner self. Now must that inmost core of selfness disappear, be burnt out, uprooted, banished, to return no more. Therefore, the fiery ordeal begins, at the end of which self will have vanished. Selflessness alone remain. One by one, external aids fall away. Friend after friend dies to him, or seems to fail. Establishments, causes, movements from which in furthering them he received support, now sustain him no more. Inwardly, the sense of isolated solitude deepens. No guide or friend remains. Even the adept guru, hitherto the one unfailing friend, cannot aid him now. The soul must stand alone, a cosmic speck in cosmic loneliness. The knowledge is then born that there is no aid outside himself, no God to whom to turn and pray, no master from whom power may be drawn. Naught in the wide expanse of emptiness exists save that which he still thinks of as himself. It is an agony which cannot be described, compounded as it is of fear mounting to terror, to be thus so utterly alone, of pain at what appears to be a cowardly betrayal by all to whom he gave his trust, and of heartbreak at the loss of love, since none seem to remain on whom to turn that love. Ice cold, in an ice cold universe, he turns perforce within to that which hitherto he thought himself, and then at last he finds that there is no separated self, but only the one great self of all. Wonderingly, his anguished half forgot, he explores the new experience. enters gradually the state of utter selflessness. Paradoxes cannot enter here, for they are based on separateness, and now he is in the presence of the One alone. Deeper he explores, and finds that oneness is enfolding him. His ancient self-fullness expands immeasurably. It seems to him that he himself stretches out into the innumerable modes of the manifestation of the One. Eventually, the remaining film of separateness can stretch no more, and in dazzling light it bursts. The separated self is gone. Only the One Self remains, and with that One he is now identified. The storm then passes. All fear forever dies away. Loneliness and sorrow at another's act towards himself can touch him nevermore. He is that other, and all others are himself. Unity, he cries. Identity, he chants. That is the truth. This is the goal. The darkness and the emptiness have gone. They had no real existence, save as states of consciousness born of the delusion of self-separateness. When that illusion dissolves, light and fullness displace darkness and emptiness. The mountaintop, pure white as of eternal snow, is now reached. Victory is gained in final mastery, founded not on self, but upon the inexhaustible and infinite power of the All-One, which is One-All. Self-crowned by his own victory, the traveller has reached the goal and has won the prize. Immortal life is his, for now he is identified with the One Immortal Life. Thus the adept attains. Thus every adept has attained. Thus one day will every separated self be reabsorbed in full consciousness back into that, THAT, in which no separateness can exist. Such is the path ahead of everyone who seeks, finds, and essays to tread the upward way. Each one who achieves makes the path easier for others. Many have achieved, breasting the strongest waves, climbing the steepest mountainsides, enduring steadfastly the greatest strain and pain. The way is easier now for all because of those who have attained. Chapter 9. The First Initiation. When the Master considers his disciple sufficiently advanced to be able to pass through initiatory tests, he presents him or her to the assembled adepts and initiates of this planet. A gathering is convened, including especially those adepts and initiates with whom the candidate has karmic bonds or in whose fields of activity he has labored and will later serve. This gathering is nearly always superphysical. The chosen place is generally one oft used for such occasions, and to it the convocation comes, traveling there in superphysical vehicles of consciousness. When the ceremony is wholly superphysical, the body of the candidate is fast asleep, physical karma having provided that essential, itself part of the test of readiness for further progress from the karmic point of view. For a man's circumstances and his reactions thereto mirror the state of his consciousness. the degree of his evolutionary development, and the state of his karmic account. Circumstance is man's surest guide in these matters, and it is a major, purely physical factor in occult advancement. Environment, condition, and opportunity have been earned under law, and that is why they so faithfully reveal a man's interior condition and his relationship with nature and his fellow men. Even so small a circumstance as privacy and sleep at the appointed time may loom large as a revelation of preparedness, and upon such, therefore, the adept master must wait. True, in exceptional cases, such as special gatherings of the adept brotherhood, unique occult occasions, a particular office to be filled, or work to be done, circumstances are molded by the adept. But even this possibility has been earned, and is within the disciple's karma. When the true time of initiation arrives, all circumstances point thereto. All forces and influences converge upon that moment and event. The zodiacal and planetary configurations, both at the disciple's birth and at the initiatory hour, indicate the potentiality and actuality of readiness for the rite. The very incidents of contact with initiates and an adept are expressive both of nature's unhurried labors within and upon the human soul, and of that soul's favorable response thereto. Naught occurs by chance, either in realms temporal or spiritual. All is first foreshadowed as latent potentiality, which has been gradually awakened and developed, and in due time hastened by occult stimulus and training, reaches the desired state. Nature carefully times her major activities and achievements. In the human kingdom, she makes allowance with unfailing care for laggards and for those in advance of the race, providing perfectly for the needs and the rights of both of them. So it is nature who is at once the mother of her newborn son, director of the adept teacher, an indicator of preparedness to the initiating hierophant and his brethren. As Isis, the Egyptian goddess, personifying nature and the secret wisdom, she receives the aspirant, dead to the illusions of the outer world, alive to the realities of the inner realm. As Maat, the Egyptian goddess personifying order, she welcomes and assesses him. As Hathor, Egyptian goddess personifying material substance and the feminine principle in nature, she adopts and suckles him as a child newborn of her with the milk of vital life and light from worlds invisible. With these, the new initiate is nourished and sustained within those worlds, which will now receive him and must be subdued by him. Wisdom is the milk of the mind, intuition the food of the brain, with which, by the goddess nature, the newborn initiate is favored and endowed. Nature, therefore, must assent before the long preparations can begin and the great ceremony be performed. Both the master and the initiator look to nature for confirmation of their judgment that the seed of adeptship exists and is germinate within the aspirant's soul. The monad fructifies that seed, is the archangelic procreator and annunciant. At the disciple's acceptance, the flashing power of the monad flamed down in response to an invocation by the master. The seed sprouted within the substance of the spiritual soul, the womb of light, which is the orgoides of the Greeks, meaning the self-radiant, divine fragment, the ego in the causal body. In the sunshine and sun power of his adeptship, the master has aided with matchless skill the young plant developing within the higher self. The roots have struck strongly down into the soil of the mind, the heart and the bodily life, drawing therefrom needed sustenance. For the adept is in part the product of idealism and of effort made by the outer man through many lives. At last, the life of lives begins, that incarnation in which the first great step from man to superman will be taken. Active idealism and intensity of effort indicate the awakened condition of the higher self and its power to influence increasingly the lower man. Deep psychological experiences, expresses of the labors of a spiritual birth, and the transference of consciousness from the concrete to the abstract intellect, and from the self-centered to the selfless attitude of mind, bring both suffering and joy, and from these parents of wisdom the initiate is born. Nature has labored mightily to bring him forth. His master has skillfully hastened and assisted the interior unfoldment. The monad has sent down its fiery power to inspire, encourage, and sustain throughout the great endeavor. An adept from the higher ranks in the occult hierarchy is chosen to preside. Under him, a lodge is formed, tiled, and opened according to ancient custom. Two masters with whom the candidate has been closely associated in his former lives and in his present life, and with whom there are affinities of ray and future destiny, these present the disciple to the initiator and the assembled brethren. The adept brotherhood, rejoicing at the promise of recruitment to its ranks, assembles to protect, as calyx, the newly opened bud. The one initiator on this earth calls down the concentrated fire of the solar Lord into the heart of the slowly opening flower. That one initiator is the loftiest being upon earth, its spiritual king, the august head of the hierarchy of earth's adepts, the Lord of the world. With kingly mien and words of power, the adept hierophant brings that power down from the spiritual sun to enfire the inner self and break the enclosing membrane which hitherto has held the bud within. The individualized self, with its sense of separated existence, born long ago at entrance into self-conscious manhood, from the instincts and habits of the animal, must now be renounced, must now die. Self-centeredness is abjured forevermore by the initiated higher self. Self-unity with the larger self of the universe, the deity, is then attained. And when all signs have shown preparedness, the initiator performs by solar power that final initiatory act from which the old Adam dies and the Christ within is born. Visible in degree, according to the observer's rank, a pillar of fire extends from the earthly spot whereat the ceremony occurs to the sun shining in full splendor above, in the midst of the heavens. The candidate is included and enveiled within the pillar at his lower end. Above, the initiated higher self shines radiantly with new-found solar rays and concentric spheres of solar light. At the summit, the monad, flashing and flaming as a silver star within the glory of the spiritual sun, is temporally united as three in one and one in three with both the ego and the personality of the candidate. Far below, the sleeping form, guarded by the angelic hosts, receives the consecrating power, and according to the law of correspondences, is quickened in its several parts to a new responsiveness to wisdom, love, and the higher intellect. The night moves on. The hours pass unnoticed by the higher self, steeped in bliss, lost in light, exalted in enlightenment. At last, all tests passed, the sacred rite is completed, the spiritual knighthood won, and the benediction shared with all that lives. Archangels chant the glories of that hour and the future splendor of that day when man newborn shall become man mature and adeptship be attained. The Hierophant withdraws. Presentations to members of the Brotherhood are made. Congratulations are received, and sometimes plans for future work are made. When morning comes, the soul returns to awaken its sleeping physical form and gradually to convey thereto the fruitage of the night's experience. Chapter 10. The Initiate Life. The chief effect upon consciousness of passage through the first initiation in the greater mysteries consists of the awakening into activity and quickened development of that principle of man in which the faculty of direct spiritual perception resides. The level of consciousness is entered by the initiated higher self at which the duality of knower and known begins to be transcended, and the unity of both to be perceived. This is the new power which initiation bestows, to realize unity, and to perceive and know from within, instead of as heretofore, from without. The object is known from within itself, the position of the observer being no longer exterior alone. External observation through the human principle of mind is supplemented by direct knowledge from within through the principle of intuition. Unity with the one self of all and with all other selves is realized consciously during the initiatory process. The principle and the faculty of intuition are awake and perceptive, The initiate enjoys full self-conscious realization of his inalienable and inseparable unity with every being and thing within the range of his perception. "I know that I am one with all," describes the condition of this consciousness. Consciously one with all, he knows all from within. The vantage point from which this knowledge is gained is the indwelling life and consciousness of every object of study. Unified therewith, he knows the object in its essential and inner nature. He sees it from without and intuitively feels it from within. His knowledge, therefore, is both deep and swiftly gained. For he now begins to be a true seer, able to pierce outer form and know the life within. Far or near, high or low, everything that comes within the range of his awareness, extended now beyond that of pre-initiate man, is perceived in wholeness instead of in part as heretofore. To the extended and heightened consciousness of initiated man, spirit and matter, life and form are now known to be one. The effect of this experience upon the outer man is to simplify his ideas. Diversity of desires, variety of concepts, multiplicity of interests are all gradually reduced, and this process culminates in singleness of mind and purpose. Discontentment with form disappears in contentment with life. Satiation with facts gives place to satisfaction with principles. He is, in consequence, sometimes regarded as a simpleton by the worldly wise. He is, however, known as simplified by the spiritually wise. The symbol for this blessed state of oneness and simplification has ever been the babe, and the initiation which produces it is allegorically described as a nativity. The initiate is a child in that he is imbued with the same singleness of purpose as is the child newborn, namely, to live. But whereas the infant's will is to satisfy its hunger with food by absorption from without, the initiate's will is to satisfy the hunger for fuller realization of his oneness with the infinite life of the universe, in the midst of which he now consciously exists. Life, therefore, is still the goal, more life the pressing need. No longer to be absorbed from without alone, but to be more deeply penetrated and realized from within. The deeps, rather than the heights, now call to him as he sinks consciously and deliberately towards the center and source of existence, which, paradoxically to the mind, is both within himself and within all other beings and things. The initiate has thus begun consciously to follow the way home to that primordial fountain which is the source of all life and all being. This quest abstracts a portion of his higher consciousness from the concerns of worldly life. Disinterested with materials, other than those he must immediately use, displaces the avid search for possessions, which once so occupied him. He therefore becomes increasingly otherworldly, his search being no longer for multiplicity of things, but for ever increasing realization of the fullness of life. These changes occur gradually as the lower man reproduces on earth the spiritual preoccupations of the higher self in its newfound heaven of boundless life. What is this life in all which now is the chief environment of the initiated higher self? It is the very soul of all souls, the ensouling principle of the universe, the indwelling vital fluid by which all creation lives. It is homogeneous, yet atomic. It is omnipresent and all-penetrating, but granular. It is all-pervading, but locally concentrated as the germ in pre-initiate man, as the active principle of awareness after initiation, and as the mastered vehicle of consciousness in the adept, bestowing upon him omniscience and omnipresence. Microcosmic spiritual suns, each a reproduction of the macrocosmic source of life, constitute the atoms of the world of universal life, into which the initiate is newborn in consciousness. This ocean, in the depths of which he finds himself, glows and gleams as with the light of myriads of suns, golden-hued. A pulse becomes gradually discernible within this universal, omnipresent heart, as that still higher principle, for which it is a vehicle, rhythmically ebbs and flows. Each atom is a heart in miniature, through which, in regular and unbroken tide, the conscious, fiery electric force, which is the substance of the universe, forever flows. This inner fire of God is not gold in color, but white. It is the alkahest, the universal solvent in alchemy. Mystically, it is that power of the higher self of man, union with which transmutes the baser human qualities into their spiritual opposites, removes the seeds of disease, renews youth, and prolongs life, as the alchemists knew. It is also the Kether, the Hebrew crown, the first sapphire of the Kabbalistic tree of life, from which the other nine are emanated. It is then the Kether, by and of which all things are created and transformed. Primordial will to manifest uses primordial wisdom as vehicle and instrument, and is linked thereby with universal mind. This is the Trinity in action, the three in one, by which all things are made, vitally sustained and consciously evolved. This is the threefold deity into whose presence the initiate is lifted up or born. Chapter 11. Difficulties and dangers on the path. The entrance of the newborn upon the initiate life places before him many problems, both external and interior. Many readjustments are demanded of him as he gradually learns to live as one who knows the unity of life and of all living things. Self-identification with that life occurred for a brief time during the initiatory rite, but cannot at first be sustained. The memory of the experience influences him, however, and the fact of unity flashes forth from within his mind with increasing frequency. On these occasions, he experiences identity with parts of nature, such as minerals, flowers, and trees. Identity with lives of animals and birds, and, of course, with his fellow men. The germ of omnipresence has been fructified and rapidly develops, producing experiences of unity as it grows. This calls for readjustments in his relationships with other men. Their spiritual welfare becomes his chief concern, and all friendship has behind it the motive to help and never to hinder them on their upward way. This applies to all men, the simple and the intellectual, the humble and the great. For all are seen and known by him as fellow pilgrims, treading the pathway to perfection. His so-called enemies, and their numbers may for a time increase, are no more resented, nor are they counter-attacked. To do so would be to attack himself and all else that lives. Non-resistance to evil directed at himself, strong defense of others who are attacked, these become the principles which guide his life. He curbs combativeness and checks the hasty, self-defensive word. Habits of mind and speech and act which express separateness must be overridden and overcome. Slowly and surely, unity in thought and word and deed dominates and marks his character and self-expression. This produces quietude, an inward poise which must be held. He lives increasingly as one who had entered a silent world, a realm of thought and being where all is still. Therein he seeks to live increasingly, self-sustained, and in a great peace. Even amidst the storms of life and the conflict and the suffering inseparable from the rapid liquidation of his karmic debts, a part of him remains tranquil in higher realms of consciousness, unmoved by those ripples which are the mighty seeming waves of lower worlds. He becomes stable as a rock amid such storms, immovable because rooted at last in the center, which is the infinite source of his own being as of the being of all that exists. Thus, the initiate grows, unfolds his powers, meets his tests, pays his debts, and establishes himself in the initiate attitude to life and being. Deep within his higher self, throughout all this time of spiritual adolescence, other powers have germinated and commenced to grow. Under the constant stimulus of the initiatory power established within him, the higher self develops, and the will and the intellect grow stronger and deeper. This power of the one initiator consists of atmic fire, will fire, and was brought to bear upon him at the touch of the thyrsus, or rod of power. Thereafter, it operates ceaselessly as an added interior stimulus, arousing from latency to potency the germs of every faculty, as also the particular powers of his ray. The current of white, fiery electrical force was brought down from solar heights into his head and heart. Ceaselessly thereafter, it plays into him as an arousing, spiritually stimulating agency. This current also empowers him personally, giving to every thought and word and deed a potency, and therefore a responsibility, not usually present to the same extent in pre-initiate phases of evolution. This is the fiery will, or Atma, of the solar Logos, with whom, through the mediation of the intermediate Logoi, the Lord of the world, and the adept Hierophant, the ego of the initiate, is the first time directly linked in consciousness and power. This descent and this more conscious unity with the central source mightily quicken the evolution of the higher self, stimulate tremendously all natural evolutionary processes, and as long as the lower self can intelligently respond, greatly hasten progress towards adeptship. Strain is therefore inseparable from the initiate life. Ceaseless pressure is applied from within to both higher and lower selves. Unity with all other lives awakens a deepening sense of responsibility for them. The weight of the heavy, adverse karma of the whole world is felt as a burden upon his own shoulders, an inescapable sorrow in his heart. He inevitably becomes a man of sorrows, for to the sorrows of mankind which he shares are added those he himself endures as his karma is forcibly precipitated and harmonized. Within, however, he is supported by knowledge of a larger life, a growing strength, and an oft-recurring ecstasy as his inner consciousness expands and realizes unity with life itself and attunement with divinity. Mental powers are expanded and increased. Comprehension of much that heretofore was incomprehensible is often swift and sure. Higher mind and lower mind are merged, and the latter, in consequence, is illumined with occult lore acquired in past lives and with knowledge of basic principles. The former selves of earlier lives share with the present man their knowledge and their power. Vision and memory restore to him the fruits of past experiences ever stored within the higher mind, but now consciously received by the lower mind and the brain. The view of life and the direction of action in this phase become increasingly intellectual, and therein lies a danger. Mind is indeed the slayer of the real, and even an initiate is not safe from the operation upon him of this law. Egotism, conceit, and pride of attainment threaten the pure simplicity and the selflessness of the newborn. He must be on guard, lest they introduce that impurity which is the taint of self. Sometimes he feels godlike as the solar power pours down into and through him. His mental powers seem most brilliant as intellect expands under its stimulus. Beware of pride, say his seniors, observing his growing power and confidence, and therefore warning him. Chapter 12, the second and third initiations. The dangers of egoism and pride averted, at least temporarily, and the pure humility still marking his thought and life, the initiate is again presented before an assembly of adepts. A second and far higher initiatory rite is then performed. A loftier grade in the greater mysteries is entered. Through the channels opened at the first initiation, and gradually widened ever since, a still deeper penetration into the boundless ocean of the one eternal life is achieved, and a far greater measure of solar power is brought to bear upon him. This time, the innermost layers of the human intellect are touched and stirred. The depths of the mind, dark hitherto because unstirring, are touched by the fiery power and set vibrating in harmony with the solar mind. Mental quickening now is intense. The spark of mind glows and bursts into flame. All comprehension and even all knowledge seem to him now to be his. If scientist by ray, discoveries are made of the occult character of the structure of matter and of the universe. If philosopher, full comprehension is attained of the universal ideation by which all things are shaped and formed, and of the archetypes upon which all forms are modeled. The whole mind, composed of higher and lower intellect, now unified, marvelously expands, and, if a student by temperament, the initiate of the second grade, grows greatly in understanding and in knowledge. The danger which besets him at this time also grows. He must be more than ever on his guard, lest the demon pride leads him into a wilderness of excessive egotism, cold mentality, and self-separateness, and there successfully tempts him. Failure comes to many aspirants at this stage. In their personalities, they may fall back, even for several lives, into the pre-initiate selfishness and separateness. Even so, unless they utterly forswear the path and denounce as enemies those who hitherto had aided them, and so erect a barrier between themselves and the sanctuary, the inward power is continuously at work in them, and eventually brings them through the depths and bears them on to still greater attainments. Work is one of the great safeguards against final severance from the mysteries. Labor for a noble cause, especially the betterment of the lot of man, will serve as bridge which can be crossed from a phase of intellectual pride to one of spiritual vision and humility. New heights are then climbed. New vision is gained. Spiritual exaltation occurs, and spiritual truth is realized. Now the path leads upwards by steeper ways to greater heights. The transformation of the lower man into the likeness of the higher must be brought about. The very flesh must be made subservient to the spirit. In preparation for the later descent of the monadic fire, when the goal of adeptship shall be attained, the light of the immortal self must shine through the mortal body. A period of retirement and retreat is generally granted to the pilgrim, whose intellect is exalted into the presence of that wisdom which is embodied in all creation. The vast ocean of eternal life, which first was entered at the spiritual birth has been deeply explored, and now that being whose vehicle it is draws the ascending pilgrim into his presence. He then sees direct that the waters of eternal life are imbued with consciousness. Intelligence pervades and dwells at rest within that boundless sea. The omnipresent life of God is vehicle for his omniscience, and into the presence of the omniscient deity the pilgrim is now drawn. The splendor and the calm power of that mighty one, who is the agent and embodiment of the one universal mind, the demiurge incarnate within the ensouling life of the universe, are awe-inspiring. An awe-inspiring figure is seen by the initiate at this great experience, radiant as a thousand suns, blazing with the splendor of that eternal fire and light with which it is self-crowned. I am the real amidst the unreal, then chants the voice. I am the light beyond the darkness, the immortality to which from death all men arise. Come thou to me. Then the initiate is received into that which is the heart of all creation. Just as disciple, he was received into the heart of his master, swallowed up within the heart of being, absorbed for a time in the very center and source of all life. His intellect is exalted, and his vehicles of consciousness transfigured. At rest at last, he remains therein, a nonentity, a selfless being, free wholly, if but temporarily, from all taint of self. He experiences that exaltation of the intellect, which follows the full renunciation by the intellect of I am-ness. For only then, when self is dead, slain by the former self, can full selflessness be attained, and union with the one self of all be achieved. This, in terms of consciousness, is the experience to which the initiate of the third degree, the transfigured one, is exalted. Again, he is not alone. Once more, the assembled adepts witness his triumph and assist in his attainment, which is by far the greatest achievement of the soul since it was formed. The temptations and the tests during passage through this stage are almost unendurable. The allurements of worldly power and intellectual eminence almost irresistible. The way to greatness and effective service seem to involve acceptance of man's estimate of his nature. The world calls to him for deliverance by intellectual power. Office, which would make him a leader of men, opens before him. Yet acceptance could make of him a slave to the illusion of self-separateness and the tempter pride. His vision of what is real and what is unreal must be clear at that hour. Intuition must penetrate unfailingly through the glamour of success and see both bait and trap within it. The not-self must be forsworn for the one self, the outer for the inner, and the false for the true. The way leads inwards, not outwards. The great journey must be made towards the center, and so away from the circumference. One office alone is at this time acceptable. It is that selected for him by the brotherhood of adepts to which his life belongs, and is not one chosen for him by the world. Hierophant he may be, whether before men or in rites closed to the outer world. He may not become a purely worldly leader, outside of and separate from that inner office and ideal, and still succeed. Hierophantship demands self-negation and self-surrender. Worldly leadership of worldly men can lead to self-fostering and so to defeat. The Judas within man lurks in the shadows at this time, waiting to betray. This is the test which both precedes and follows the initiation of transfiguration, and through it every transfigured initiate has passed triumphantly to stand amongst his peers upon that mount which is the scene of every similar triumph. The full withdrawal of the consciousness from every semblance of form into the heart of life then occurs. The initiate is received by life, is acknowledged by life, and is crowned by that deific power for which eternal life is the unresisting and all-pervading vehicle. Never again need form delude and capture him, even though he must return to life in form, for now he knows the one eternal life and has been made one with that which abides therein, the life-embodied universal mind. Chapter 13, the fourth and fifth initiations. The last ordeal leading to the final triumph must now be endured. Transfigured on high, the initiate of the third degree voluntarily descends to the depths. The world of men must receive him, if for the last time. Debts outstanding to nations and to individuals must be paid. Nature will exact to the uttermost the full payment of every debt incurred. All pain inflicted throughout the long series of his lives, and as yet not healed by him, must now be healed. The balance still weighs heavily against him. Throughout his 700 human lives or more, he has grievously transgressed the law of brotherhood, injuring individuals, groups, and multitudes. All that he exacted must by now have been repaid. All that he wounded and has not healed must now wound him, that full payment may be made and perfect balance be achieved. Therefore he must voluntarily descend from those spiritual heights whereon he was transfigured into the world of men, wherein he will appear to be debased. Not yet for him ultimate absorption into that with which temporarily he was at one. Not yet his final deliverance from humanity and all its woes. Nevertheless, the memory of the heights is with him. The power of the monad sustains him, and the unfailing support of that life wherein he seeks one day to disappear is now assured to him, even though the passion of suffering associated with the fourth initiation may temporarily deprive him of the knowledge. He steps forward towards his goal and into that cruelest of all tribunals, the false judgment of mankind. He is not yet adept, and so has weaknesses. He is not yet free from indebtedness, and so is vulnerable. He is yet man, and so displays humanity. His honor is assailed. His regal bearing provokes the scorn of lesser men, and his purity of life is made a subject of mockery. If he possesses occult powers wherewith to defend himself, he may not use them now. Supernormal powers may only be used for the work of the Brotherhood and the helping of certain men, never for self. Hence he is powerless and defenseless, although in truth a man of power and potent to defend. This must be so, since absolute selflessness is his goal. Soon the cruel blows begin to fall on him. Soon the multitude spit on him and demand his death in ignominy. Soon, therefore, a darkness closes over him. Pain blinds him. Agony benumbs his brain, so that for a time his spiritual vision is lost and he believes himself utterly alone. His inner invincible will alone remains throughout that dread ordeal, the will which will never yield, though all else fail. That will, born of descending monadic fire, surges up within him, rises to heights almost fanatical, and so sustains him when all external aid seems gone. He who has been one with universal life and mind now in his passion becomes one with universal will. Then he is spiritually crowned. Then the fourth great stage is passed, the fourth initiation bestowed, and the inscription written in that book wherein the imperishable record of his life is written. Not over his head that men can see, but in nature's memory, the Akash, is imprinted forever the record of his victory. Will-crowned, will-robed, will-enthroned, the initiate of the fourth degree arises from that crucifixion, which is but his human self, with its sense of separateness. Now he is drawn into unity with the universal will, the power omnipotent which arose within him in his hour of need and sustained him to the end. Nirvana, salvation, liberation awaits him when his last work as man shall have been done, his last lesson learnt, his last power developed, and his last and highest skill attained. Then, as initiate of the fifth degree, the weapon of his human nature, tempered to the utmost and keen-edged, he, the warrior victorious, lays down his arms and enters into peace. The victory which he attained as man is his forevermore. Naught can ever again successfully assail him. His debts paid, his discharge complete, he is immune from every harm. As adept, self-initiated at the last, even though he may engage in strife to help the world, he himself is nevermore involved in war. He has ascended above the storm, beyond all strife. Serene in ecstasy, he lives at one with the will and life and mind of the Supreme. The path by which he now ascends to heights invisible to all save supermen stretches beyond the gaze of man. That which he achieved on earth, he extends into the solar system and ratifies it there. Then beyond, into broader cosmic realities, the adept extends his mastery, ascending height upon height towards a cosmic goal. Finally, he will be lost to manifested worlds, to wait in full self-consciousness on the threshold of the unmanifest, until that evening hour in the cosmic day when, with him, all shall sink back into the absolute.